All right, so we're going to look at what we're calling a weekend with Jesus. It's a unique section in the Gospels where we get to see, you know, three subsequent days of Jesus interacting with his disciples, with the crowds. In some ways, it's comparable to the detail that we have surrounding the last week of Jesus' life, where we have a kind of almost day-by-day account of what's going on. We have something similar in this weekend at the beginning of his ministry. We're going to be primarily focused on Luke chapter 5 and Mark chapter 1. We'll explain how those passages relate to one another as we go along. So our objectives for today are to be able to list at least one event for each day of the weekend that's recorded in these two chapters, to be able to name three men who fell on their faces in response to a revelation of divine glory, and to be able to explain how the weekend that's described in these chapters would have prepared the apostles for their eventual work in the kingdom. And along the way, I think we'll be able to draw some good applications for ourselves. So we'll be on the lookout for those. For this class, we're covering a relatively small number of verses, and so I'd like to take the opportunity, because of that, to actually read these verses so we can all hear them. Can I get a volunteer to read Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11?
I got it, Mason.
Okay.
On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake. Fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out in the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered him, "Master, we toiled all night and took nothing, but at your word I will let down the nets." And when he had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. They signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him.
Thanks, Jack. So Jesus leaves Capernaum and goes down to the sea. We know this from Mark chapter 1, verse 16. I don't know how useful this is to anybody, but one of the questions in the lesson was to try to find all the other names for the Sea of Galilee, and it kind of depends on where you're looking in history. Gennesaret is a very old name. The Sea of Galilee is the name that is generally used in the New Testament. Occasionally you'll hear it referred to as the Sea of Tiberias. That's a little bit later name, but it does show up in some of the accounts. Just to help you kind of read the text a little bit better, to know that all those names refer to the same body of water, which is really not very big, but still provides important water and employment for the region at this time period and even today.
Please.
So we're going to be putting these accounts together from Mark 1 and Luke 5, but Luke chapter 5, verse 5, which we just read, implies that Jesus approaches them early in the morning, and that's where the title of this section in the lesson, Friday morning, comes from. Is if they've been fishing all night and Jesus approaches them, you know, it would make sense that it's first thing in the morning, especially given that he then starts to teach them, starts to teach the crowds. It would imply that Jesus comes out or first thing in the morning and a crowd follows him out to hear him teach. So Jesus gets in the boat and begins to teach the multitudes in verse 3. And, you know, if you ever go to Israel and go to the Sea of Galilee, there are lots of places where they'll show you that you know, prove that this is the right, this is the place because of the acoustics and stuff like that. Maybe, I don't know. It's not really the point of this story. The point of this story, as we will see, is about teaching the multitudes and also about training the disciples. And as part of that training, even before he's actually called them, Jesus demonstrates to them what being a fisher of men is going to look like. He gets in the boat just like a fisher would, and he sits there like a fisher would, and he's putting out, for lack of a better term, bait, hoping that people will take it and be interested and come into the kingdom. I mean, he's doing everything that a fisherman would do, showing the disciples what it means to be fishers of men. And then after he teaches the crowd, maybe they're dispersing, maybe they're not. The text is not really clear on that. But Jesus makes this miraculous catch of fish appear. And I think for a long time I misunderstood really what was going on in the narrative. I think that what I had in mind was like they'd been trying all night, right? Like put the net down and you're trawling or whatever and you just don't pull anything up, or you put a line in the water and you reel it in time after time and there's nothing on it. That's really not apparently the way they fished in those days. The easiest way that they would fish is, I'm trying to not give you too much detail in case you don't care, but that the fish would sort of school on the surface of the water when there was food available. And you could see that. You could see the water, you know, churning, and then you'd throw a net in on top of them and pull the net up and you'd have the fish. So when they say we've been fishing all night and have caught nothing, they don't mean we've been trying but we kept failing. What they mean is we didn't see a thing all night long. It isn't that the fish are there and we can't get them. It's that the fish aren't there. We would have seen them if they were. They're not there. And so Peter's faith in agreeing to do what Jesus tells him to do is maybe more admirable than I actually thought it was, because it isn't just, well, I guess we can try one more time. It's, this doesn't make any sense at all. This isn't the way fishing works. You don't fish in clear water. You wait till the fish come and then you grab them and the fish aren't here. And I think there's an important message for both for the disciples that Jesus is about to call to follow him and for us, which is that if Jesus can make you successful in fishing, he can make the fish appear from nowhere. He can make you successful in fishing for men. He's showing them by his example and by this miracle that he does for them that he will be the source of their success as fishers of men. And I think that that would have been an important lesson for the disciples in this moment. Now, before I go on to anything about this that you have questions about or comments? Is this the first time you've heard that idea about the way they would fish?
Yeah, I'm not sure you're right. Sounds made up.
All right, good. At least you're listening. Well, feel free to research that. But that's that is and apparently even the names for the nets that they use in Greek refer to those. I forget what they're called, but the nets that are weighted, you throw them out and they fall down to the bottom and you scoop them up. The Greek word actually refers specifically to those nets when it says they were cleaning their nets or repairing their nets or whatever. So
I think they actually have a pretty useful display, and they talk about this down at that museum in LaGrange. It's a very good point.
Yep. Good. I didn't know that. So now you can all go there and prove me right instead of having to travel all the way to Israel. I've just saved you several thousand dollars. One thing you may have noticed if you kind of looked back on your page in Luke chapter 5 is that Luke places this event after the other events of this weekend. You read Luke, the end of Luke 4, he's got healing Simon Peter's mother and the people coming to see him after it was dark, and the next morning when he went out by himself. Luke puts this event after that. The call is nearly identical, the fishers of men call that he gives them, which is why it seems to make the most sense that it would be a single event. And given that the other two accounts, Matthew and Mark, put this before the other events of the weekend, we tend to assume that Luke is the one who has it out of order. And that's also partly the way Luke starts the account. He says, now it came to pass. That generally indicates it's a different time, which may mean that it's just out of order. But if you think about the way we tell stories, that's actually not that difficult to understand. If someone asked you to describe your weekend and you had a bunch of really cool things happen to you, you might describe them in chronological order. But if you were a really good storyteller, wouldn't you save the best thing for last? Right? You'd say, and the coolest thing that happened the whole weekend was when Jesus got in our boat and we put the net down where there were no fish and suddenly it's full of fish. That was when I knew that I needed to follow him and be his disciple. And maybe that's what's going on in Luke's account. He's interviewing people and they keep saying, but the coolest thing that happened the whole weekend. And so he, to make his point about the evidence that Jesus is presenting to his disciples, that he is who he claims to be, Luke puts this at the end. That's just a theory based on my experience, not on any close study of the text, but it does seem to make sense. But in any case, the other accounts put this story at the beginning of the weekend on Friday morning. Anything else about this episode before we move on?
I think it's commendable, Mason, that after a long night, they listened to Jesus' teaching, but then they were willing to go back out and do something they'd already spent a great amount of time doing. I can only imagine they must have been tired, but for whatever reason, they had enough faith or belief or hope because Jesus said it, that they were going to do it anyway. That's commendable.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute because of the way that Peter reacts to it, right? The reaction falling down before Jesus clearly indicates what you're saying, that this is more than just, oh, that's a lot of fish, that there's some expectation, some trust that Jesus is more than just a normal person. And we know from our last class that they've already seen him do some miracles, including some miracles where things that weren't there before suddenly appeared, right? Where he turned water to wine. So they're sort of prepped for this. They're ready to listen to him. It is commendable that they listened to him after having, you know, been out all night or part of the night. Jesus is clearly very intentionally building these men's faith. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. In some ways, the notable event about this story is Peter's response, falling down before Jesus and asking him to depart. Can you remember some other Bible characters who had similar reactions to revelations of God's nature and power? I'm thinking about things like the falling down or asking, you know, God or Jesus to go away. Or
was it Isaiah that said, I'm a man of unclean lips?
Yep. Very good.
And then, of course, Paul on the road to Damascus saw Jesus.
And fell down, in fact.
Fell down, yep.
Yep. Yep. Anybody else? So here's the ones that I came up with, and I think this is not a complete list, and it also depends on how you want to define your terms. I mean, you would also like have the reaction of Samson's parents to the angel where they fell down, and it's kind of a funny scene, right? His dad says, oh, we're going to die, and his mom says, no, if we were going to die, we'd be already dead. So things are probably going to be okay. It's like, clearly, they're married to each other because they're talking to each other like that. But anyway, so depending on how you want to define this, maybe you might add more to the list. But remember Israel at Mount Sinai? They didn't want to go near the mountain. They trembled and stood at a distance, the implication being even farther back than they had to based on the boundary. You remember that in 2 Samuel 6, David was afraid of the Lord after Uzzah was killed. First, he's angry, and then he's afraid of the power that God displays. Ezekiel, when he has his vision of God in Ezekiel 1, he fell on his face. Isaiah, Ken mentioned, says, I'm ruined because I'm a man of unclean lips. Again, this confession of sin in response to the holiness of God. Saul's vision of Christ. and John's vision of Christ in Revelation, John says, I fell at his feet like a dead man. That was interesting because John knew Jesus. They were very close. And yet in his heavenly glory, he's still frightening. I think that says a lot about the power of God and the glory of Christ. So here are some other instances of this happening. I'd like us to think about how these compare to what Peter saw that caused him to fall down. Let's try to think about this question. How do you explain Peter's reaction? In some ways, what Peter saw was not that impressive. When you compare it to an entire mountain smoking and shaking and a voice that you can't even bear to listen to, shouting Ten Commandments at you, right? Or this vision of wheels and thrones and beasts and things that don't make sense, or a vision of God sitting on a throne high and exalted and the train of his robe fills the temple, or a vision of the resurrected Christ in glory in the cases of John and Paul. I mean, I could see falling down and asking God to go away because of that, but over some fish? Why do you think Peter reacted that way?
Well, I don't know if it's his reason or not, but he did. He was a fisherman. He did know the fishing trade. He knew that they'd been out all night and didn't catch anything.
Yep.
And the sea was the same way. But yet here was somebody that had never maybe had been fished for the net, and he pulls in this load that sinks two boats. That's pretty impressive.
Yes, I agree. I think that's an important part of it.
Mason, Blaine here, I'll give a shot. I said that Peter had an appreciation for God's righteousness. So, you know, you can be impressed by a miracle and one's power, but it seemed to me that Peter was aware of his own sins and shortcomings and failings in comparison to some standard that he viewed as a very, very high standard, and that standard was God or his holiness or his righteousness or his perfection. So he himself, in contrast to that, is, I think, part of what was driving him to his knees.
I think that's right. I think that's a good point. So really, those are the points that I drew out of this. The miraculous catch spoke his language, right? And I think in some ways it's comparable to Isaiah, who's a descendant of David the king, seeing God on a throne in this period of kind of political turmoil when the current king has died, right? This is speaking Isaiah's language about kingship. And this is the same with Peter, as Ken pointed out. He's a fisherman. He knows how impossible this catch is, and he immediately understood that the power and authority of God was being exercised in this miracle. It's not just luck. It is the power of God and the authority of God over nature that is at work. And Blaine's point, I agree. The miracle, I think, confirmed and emphasized the truth of the teaching that he had just heard from Jesus and the testimony of John and Andrew that this man was the Christ as part of this larger revelation of God's glory in the life of Christ and then in the life of Peter. And then I think, and Blaine talked about this as well, that he becomes maybe doubly aware of his own inadequacy. One is that he's a fisherman in the presence of the creator of the fishes and the water, right? And he kind of sees that it doesn't matter how much I know or what kind of skill I have, this person is clearly greater than that. But then also as a sinful man in the presence of the Holy One of Israel. And that inadequacy that Blaine described, I think, would definitely motivate him. But the way he would know that this was the Holy One of Israel was by the teaching that he had previously heard, by the miracle that has just been performed, demonstrating divine power. So given all of those things, he can make a moral application from something that is really just a physical, miraculous, but still a physical circumstance. And so how does Peter get from real fish in real water to I'm sinful and you're not? I think it's because he is aware of the the context of who John said Jesus was, who Peter's experience has shown Jesus to be, kind of coming to fruition in this moment. So this is useful for us. It's a chance to kind of get inside Peter's head, to think through the things that he's thinking through, and then maybe, and perhaps most importantly, to try to apply it to our own lives. Because I think if we are not impressed by God's works, either the works that are visible to us in the world every day, non-miraculous, but still amazing, or the works that are done that miraculously in the scripture, I don't think it's the problem. I don't think it's God's fault, and I don't think it's that the works aren't adequate. I think it's our fault. I think it's because we're not viewing them honestly. And I think about what Jesus would say to the cities that were within visual distance of where he's standing at this moment in Matthew 11 when he says, "Woe to Chorazin and Bethsaida and Capernaum." Because if the works that had been done in you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, of all places, they would have repented. And if it had been done in Nineveh, they would have repented. And I think the point, the implication there is not that these people were somehow dumber or the signs were less impressive, but that they just weren't, they weren't listening and watching honestly. But Peter gives us an example of what honest listening and of looking looks like. James, you're muted.
I was saying something to Loretta, but...
Oh, sorry.
No, but I did want to say something. So, with saying all that about Peter, but we know how his life, that in some points it seems like he completely forgets about what he just acknowledged about Jesus.
Yep.
And you're going, so... And I guess this is why we like Peter, because it seems like that's, you know, we have these moments of great revelation, conviction, and then it seems like the next day we completely forget, you know, whether it's our trust and these other things, almost like to forget, like, who is Jesus again? And this is just, like I said, right off of here, you see this, but then it's like, it doesn't stay long. And so that's it.
And I think it's maybe not coincidental that in 2 Peter 1, he says, my job is to remind you. I'm gonna keep telling you these things because it's important and you need to know them. And, you know, it's one of those things where, and if you've preached sermons a little bit, you know this, that the best sermons you preach are the ones that are about the things you're struggling with, right? And maybe that's what Peter has in mind. He's like, guys, I forget too, so I'm going to remind you. That's a good point, yeah. Okay, so the next morning, they go back into the city, apparently, and the next morning they're going to go to the synagogue. Can I get someone to read Mark chapter 1, verses 21 to 31?
I'll get it, Mason.
Thank you.
I'm reading from the American Standard, so I'd open it and throw somebody off. But anyway. And they go into Capernaum, and straightway on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as having authority and not as the scribes. And straightway there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, saying, What have we to do with thee, Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee, who thou art, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, Hold thy peace, and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, tearing him and carrying him, crying with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, insomuch as they questioned among themselves, saying, What is this, a new teaching? With authority he commanded even unclean spirits, and they obey him. And the report of him went out straightway everywhere into all the region of Galilee around about. And straightway, when they were come out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's wife, mother, lay sick of a fever, and straightway they tell him of her. And he came and took her and by the hand and raised her up, and the fever left her, and she ministered unto them.
Thanks, Ken. I'm reading from the American Standard, too, so it made perfect sense to me. So Jesus goes into the synagogue and he teaches, not really a surprise there. And they're amazed at the authority of his teaching, verse 22 tells us. It's interesting that all three synoptic gospels record this reaction almost in those literal same words. Early in Jesus' ministry, the account in Luke 4 of this same event contains the same reaction. And you'll also remember that that's how those who heard him responded at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 7. And the Sermon on the Mount appears to have taken place in Galilee early in Jesus' ministry. So we're kind of dealing with these early reactions to what he has to say. Part of the reason I brought up the Sermon on the Mount, though, is that it gives us an example of what they're talking about, of this radical but authoritative teaching, this incredible, you might even say divine, balance between shocking us with things that are so obvious and yet we've never realized them, and also with simple and clear applications that will help us make our lives better, that characterizes Jesus' teaching. So we're blessed to have it. We're not going to really look at the Sermon on the Mount in this class, but if you're interested in kind of what did Jesus sound like when people are amazed at the authority of his teaching, I think it sounds like the Sermon on the Mount, and we're blessed to have that to read. As we read, a demon-possessed man interrupts the service. Jesus rebukes the unclean spirit and casts it out of the man. But the point, I think, is that once again, Jesus is confirming his teaching with a sign that, like Peter, his audience can understand. They know what a disruption in the synagogue looks like because it just happened. And they know that this man is possessed with an unclean spirit, and that was apparently a common phenomenon at the time. This would have been familiar to them. And the fact that Jesus is able to rebuke the spirit and make it be quiet and then cast it out of him demonstrates his power and his authority and his divinity. And unlike later interactions in this very same part of the world, and I'm thinking of John 6 in this sense, the crowd is amazed both by the teaching and by the sign, verse 27. They were all amazed that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this, a new teaching?" And with authority, he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. They're amazed by both things. Later, when he breaks the bread and feeds 5,000, they're only amazed by the sign, and they don't want to hear the teaching. So again, this is characteristic of Jesus' early ministry and of the work that he's doing. So then Jesus goes to Peter's house, heals his mother-in-law. For Peter, this must have been a great moment of his life that he often looked back on. But it's interesting that it doesn't read in the text like Peter asked Jesus to come and do that. It's like Jesus, they invited him over for lunch after synagogue service because he's the guest preacher. You always try to get the meeting preacher over to your house on Sunday, right? Paula usually takes care of that for us. But Peter here invites Jesus over after synagogue, and then they say, "Oh, by the way, his mother-in-law is here and she's sick." They told Jesus about it when he came in. So, I think maybe we're seeing a little bit of Peter's selflessness, maybe exhibited in that he is not trying to take advantage of this relationship that he's clearly developing with Jesus. He's called him to be his disciple. But Peter doesn't see that as an opportunity to get things for himself. Maybe I'm making too much of that. I don't know. Anyway, Jesus heals her and she begins serving them. So if signs are intended to produce belief in the ones who observe them, Jesus is doing a lot to foster belief in among his disciples early in his ministry. And I can't help but wonder if that's because he's going to ask so much of them later on. You think about what Jesus would ask them to do, to give up, where he'd ask them to go, what he'd ask them to suffer. And I think it's not surprising that he's doing a lot of things privately, even inside Peter's house, in the boat, in order to build their faith. These men are going to be critical to the work that God has for the church to do. And Peter in particular is going to be critical in that work. And Jesus seems to be taking the time to build their faith. And you know, the fact that we have these events recorded for us ought to be a reminder to us that we are expected to have similar levels of faith, and that we should learn from these experiences as much as Peter and James and John and Andrew all did. Anything else you want to say about this this episode with the demon-possessed man and healing Peter's mother-in-law? Dustin, were you waving your hand? Okay.
If somebody's ahead of me, go ahead.
I don't think so.
I just want to say, I think it's interesting that the demons recognized who Jesus was and everybody else didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, for a class about Peter, I didn't – this is one of those, we're not going to go into the meaning of every passage moments, I guess. But, yeah, it is. It's right. It's in this early part of – well, and we will talk about this in a minute. In this early part of Jesus' ministry, it seems like everything's going right. You know what I mean? Like, the people are all interested. He's gathering loyal disciples. The demons are you know, obedient to him, and but they know who he is, so it's not like it's hidden, you know. And yet, in just, you know, a couple of years, it's all going to start to go horribly wrong from an earthly perspective. But yeah, I mean, I think even though, and we often make this point, the demons aren't the ones you want preaching the gospel. I think still, if you were approaching their testimony from a place of faith, believing that Jesus is who he says he is, and then it's confirmed by this supernatural being, even if they're on the other side, I think that would actually build your faith. It's the people who are not sure yet that Jesus is worried about when he is commanding them to be silent. So I think it would still have been a kind of a moment of realization for his disciples to see that it really is, you know, somebody special. Even the demons understand that. Okay, let's read about that evening, Saturday evening. This is Mark 1:32 to 34. This is the shortest reading in the lesson, so if you want to read a short one, volunteer now. And unmute yourself.
I got you.
Thank you, Dustin.
At evening, when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city gathered together at the door. Then he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him.
Thank you. So after sunset, the whole city, which we kind of said last time was probably about 1,500 people, maybe on the Sabbath you might have more if people were coming in from the countryside, but we'll just go with about 1,500. Gather at Peter's door. Jesus heals the sick. He casts out demons. It's interesting that Mark, the account in Mark says that he healed many and cast out many demons, not all of them. And in fact, we know that wasn't all of them because they came looking for him the next morning wanting him to do more, right? And so sometimes the question is raised, well, why didn't he heal all of them? And maybe it's a time factor. I mean, he was laying his hands on them, Luke says in his account of this story. So maybe it's just you can only touch so many people, you know, before you run out of time. But I think there may be something more to it than that. We often make the point, and it's a good point, that Jesus didn't come to just fix people's physical problems. And that is true. We'll see that that lesson demonstrated in just a minute. But I can't help but wonder, in this context of building the disciples' faith for the work that he would have for them later, if he's not laying the groundwork for his declaration of purpose, which is about preaching the gospel that he's going to make in just a few verses, right? So kind of like getting in the boat and sitting down and casting off from the shore and fishing for men, maybe Jesus is demonstrating his point before he makes it to his disciples here as well, that, you know, you can't heal everybody, and that's not our job. And then later he will kind of tell them that. I'm really making the same point maybe that we always make, but I want us to see this occurrence in the context of Jesus building their faith and showing them by his own actions what he will require of them. And I can't, I've I've told you all about this song before, but I can't help – I can't talk about Mark 1, 32 through 34 without mentioning this song again. It's not in our book. The tune is very, very difficult, so even I probably won't overlead it. But it's a song that is based on this occurrence in Mark chapter 1, but it allegorizes the sicknesses and the demons that people who were brought to him had. And the song makes the point that we have things like that that we also need to be healed from. I find this song incredibly moving, but also incredibly convicting as I think about the healing that Jesus still offers to each of us, the fact that he's still waiting for us to bring him our problems, to come to him and to be healed. And so I would just say even small passages like this, it's just a few verses. It seems to almost be a bridge between the synagogue scene and healing in the previous verses and the kind of declaration of his mission in the next verses. And yet there's just such a critical lesson for us to learn from these verses. So if you have a chance, these are just some of the verses from this song. Look them up, and I hope you find them as helpful and as convicting as I do. Anything you want to say about this particular episode before we move on? Okay, well, let's talk about Sunday morning. If I could get someone to read Mark chapter 1, verses 35 to 39.
I'll get it, Mason.
Thank you.
And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns, that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons.
Thank you. So Jesus gets up, goes out into the countryside to pray. We shouldn't be surprised, and I think we're not, that Jesus prayed regularly and at length. And maybe this is just an example for us that we should also pray, but I can't help, again, but put this in context and think he's about to set off on a kind of first preaching tour around Galilee. And he's going to take his disciples with him. He's just called them to follow him, and they've left everything. This is a big first step in the work that he came to accomplish. And I would think that would be an important moment to go and pray for a long time to prepare for that. But another application that we might draw from this, that he gets away from the people who are going to be looking for him to continue to do miracles and even to continue to teach them, is this application that maybe even doing God's work can distract us from prayer and our personal relationship with God. That it's possible to get so busy teaching and preaching and evangelizing and training our children to love God that we neglect our own relationship with God. And I think Jesus provides us an example of not doing that, of taking the time to pray and to talk to God, to prepare for the work that he has to do, and to keep himself focused on who God is and on the mission that God has given him. Any thoughts about that? I'd be glad for somebody to say something.
Nothing too insightful, I don't think. But, I mean, just setting an example for Peter as well, and clearly the other disciples. But just how grueling, I guess, this work was going to be. Being prepared to have a long day and long week, long month of doing things like this, but yet still waking up very early in the morning and setting that example. I mean, even later on before he's crucified, showing that example of prayer there. And I like looking through the early When Peter's preaching in the book of Acts and seeing how grueling that would have been for him, time-consuming, and you just get this perfect example from Jesus.
Yep. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so then Peter and the others, presumably these are the other disciples, but there may have been others besides, they go out and find Jesus, which says he's not like, he didn't walk 30 miles, you know, he's just kind of out where he won't be immediately obvious where he is. But they ask him to come back, and it could be that the people wanted to be healed, it could be that people wanted to listen to Jesus' teaching. Later we know they really just want the miracles, but at least right now, as we've said, they do seem to be interested in what he has to say. But Jesus explains to them that his mission is to preach and not simply to work miracles. Again, I think building on the example that he set for them the previous night. But it's maybe worth pointing out, we've been giving Peter a lot of credit in this lesson, so maybe let's not give him the benefit of the doubt here. It's possible that Peter and the others may have been trying to help Jesus build a political support base for his kingdom, right? It's like, okay, he's the Messiah. Well, we know what the Messiah is going to do. He's going to establish a kingdom. So, look, we've already got a bunch of people who are interested in following him. Let's build on that. Let's keep the momentum going. Even as late as after the resurrection in Acts chapter 1, they're still kind of thinking in those earthly political terms. And so this early in his career, before he's really explained the truth to them about his kingdom, would not surprise me if they have these kind of political ideas in mind. And so I've got a repeat here of the previous bullet point, but Jesus makes it clear that that's not what he's about. And the preaching and the miracles of Jesus are, as we've been saying, examples for the apostles for the time when they are going to be responsible for the spread of the kingdom. And so, in Acts chapter 2, when Peter says, "Men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God to you by mighty works and wonders and signs which God did by him in the midst of you, even as you yourselves know," Peter is referring to these events. The things that they had seen Jesus do, the healings and the teachings and the feeding and the casting out of demons, Jesus is laying the groundwork for that. And so it's important for him not to simply be tied to Capernaum and have a Capernaum-based ministry, but to go around into the other cities, the other areas, all throughout Judea, and even, as we have already seen, into Samaria, and then he'll eventually get up into some Gentile territories briefly, but to set the stage for the apostles by showing himself in all these places and showing his power and divinity to the people that eventually would be taught the gospel. And so that's part of the motivation, I think, for Jesus to go out and preach in other cities also. So just very quickly, we're almost out of time. Some important lessons from this weekend. I think we see that Jesus will equip his disciples for the work that he calls them to do, and he will be the source of their success. And so he calls them to be fishers of men, but he also equips them for that work, both by example and by the things that he will teach them. And the miraculous signs that Jesus and the apostles performed should confirm the truth of the message being spoken, which was how Peter understood that, but also to create further opportunities for teaching. And I think the disciples would have learned that when a large crowd gathers, you just start preaching. That's what you do. And it's what Jesus does on a couple of different occasions here. And I think not coincidentally, it's what Peter does in Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 3, Acts chapter 4, it's just like that's the MO of the apostles, is you get people together, sometimes miraculously, sometimes not, and you start preaching the gospel to them. Jesus sets that example for them very early on. And this principle that the gospel should be taken into the next town is what Jesus says. But later he will say, preach it in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and even to the ends of the earth. And just like with all these other ones, he is he's showing them an example of that very early on. Really, before they understand anything about what he came to do, he's already setting them up for success in the work that he will give them. So as we move forward into the coming lessons, I would encourage you to think about where in Peter's life is he going to apply these lessons? What is he learning here that will help him in his work of preaching and teaching later in his career? So I'll just review the objectives. So events from each day, I think you probably knew those already, but maybe now you know which day they occurred on. Three men who fell on their faces. Out of that list, the three that we know who fell on their faces were Ezekiel, Saul, and John, Peter, of course. I didn't put him on this list because he's the subject of the lesson, but anyway. And then explain how the weekend described here would have prepared them. We just talked about all these, showing that Jesus would give them success, clarifying the purpose of miraculous signs, placing the emphasis on teaching above all else, and exemplifying preaching the gospel to every creature, as he would later commission them to do. Okay, so next time we're going to talk about Peter among the apostles, the selection of the apostles and some of the events surrounding that. And Jack's going to teach that one. So thank you for your time. I managed to only go 3 minutes over this time, so I'm getting better. And we'll see everybody on Sunday. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mason.
Thank you, Mason.
Thanks, Mason.